Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. A Google engineer believes that the company's artificially intelligent chatbot generator, Lambda, has come to life. The engineer concluded this last fall after he began talking to the program as a part of his job. His Google bosses disagree, saying that an internal review of the claims found significant evidence to the contrary. Will Oramus analyzes the latest tech news for the Washington Post. He's been covering the story. Welcome back, Will.
Thanks, Ann. Nice to be here.
So, all right. So artificial intelligence, I mean, this was bound to happen eventually, you know, because everyone, people watch too much science fiction, but is this exciting, scary, or really nothing to think about at all?
You could look at it any of those three ways. And yes, it was bound to happen. In fact, to a degree, it's happened before. So ever since Alan Turing, back in 1950, proposed the idea that a computer could be so sophisticated as to fool a human into thinking that it was human, computer programmers have tried to design programs to do just that. They've taken it as a sort of a challenge. Can we design a machine, a software program that passes the so-called Turing test, where a human couldn't distinguish between a machine and a person? And at various times, people have managed to build chatbots that do fool some people in some settings for a brief time. This development is noteworthy because those types of chatbots have gotten far, far more complex in the past 5 to 10 years, with companies like Google and OpenAI and Facebook leading the charge. And now this model fooled not just sort of a random observer, it fooled one of Google's own engineers into thinking that it was sentient, that it had feelings. And, you know, if you talk to him, he still believes that it does. But most experts disagree. They say there's no way it could.
What is the Turing test?
So the way Alan Turing, of course, being the famous British programmer who helped win World War II, actually, by solving the German Enigma machine, devised a test that he called the imitation game. And the idea is you have an interrogator, a person, and then sort of behind a screen, you know, where they can't see, there are two conversants, and one is a human, one is a machine, a software program. And the interrogator has to talk to both and try to decide which one is the human and which one is the machine. And if the interrogator can't tell or guesses wrong, then the machine is said to have passed the Turing test.
You know, it's interesting Alan Turing predicted this. Back when he was alive, he died way too young. But back when he was alive, I mean, this was the 50s. How did he manifest how did he know that we were getting to this?
Well, computers were a cutting edge technology at the time. I mean, giant things, big old computers, yeah, in a room. He foresaw that eventually they would be digital, and that over time their complexity would grow rapidly. It's sort of a fundamental property. He was a student not only of computers, but he was a mathematician. He also understood some about the workings of the human brain. I mean, there's a way of looking at the human brain where it's just a ton of ones and zeros in there, with neurons firing or not firing, all connected to each other in the most intricate way. And so far, nobody has designed a computer that is as complex as the human brain in terms of the ability to learn all sorts of things and take in all sorts of sensory inputs and convert them to outputs that are appropriate to the environment we know on Earth. But they're getting closer and closer to replicating some parts of the human brain, and particularly with language. These machines don't process language the same way we do, as far as we know. What they do is they are trained on vast, vast data sets of language written by humans. So language taken from Reddit, from social media, from Wikipedia, encyclopedias, wherever they can get human written language, they will take that. That machine will read, I mean, more of that, you know, more of that text than any human ever could. And from that, it will recognize the patterns in the language so that it can generate language that sounds very, very much like our own.
But what is its most motivation?
Well, you know, different people have had different motivations in designing these types of machines. Google, their latest model, the one that the engineer believes has sort of come to life or become sentient, is called Lambda. It is meant for conversation. It's meant to generate human sounding language. And there are different commercial applications of this. So when you talk to, if you have a Google Home or an Alexa, you are talking to an AI of sorts. And these companies want it to understand your language just like a human would, and they want it to be able to respond just like a human would. They don't want it to feel like talking to a computer. They want it to feel like talking to an intelligent human. And so when Google builds a model like Lambda, they're looking to take some of those findings from Lambda and put that in the Google Assistant that people talk to on their kitchen counter. It's also very useful for search. So when you type a search into the Google search engine, Google, it's, you know, in the old days, it would just match keywords, right? It would take the words you searched and look for web pages that had those keywords on them. Well, that turned out to be very gameable by websites of all kinds. So over the years, they've gotten more and more sophisticated in trying to figure out what are you actually getting at with your search? I mean, what are you trying to find out? And then which of these different search results that we could show you are really answering your question? And in fact, they now look for where is the part on the page where they answer your question so that Google can just give you the answer instead of sending you to different links. So those are the types of applications that we see for this type of technology.
And what about the engineer, Blake, is it LeMoyne or?
Blake LeMoyne, Google engineer.
Who is he? How did he come to this conclusion? What's his evidence?
This is with the story written by my colleague, Natasha Tiku, and she interviewed LeMoyne about his experiences with Lambda. And she even got to try Lambda with him at her side. Now, LeMoyne is an interesting guy. I mean, everybody who knows him says that he's intelligent, a very sensitive person. Growing up, he dabbled in some sort of mystic religion, and he acknowledges that his evidence is not scientific. His evidence that Lambda is sentient is not scientific. It's based on his religious beliefs, but he believes that any thing that can converse on this level and evince sort of this depth of apparent understanding must have some degree of sentience or personhood or rights consciousness. It's easy for some to sort of shrug off as there was one blog post responding to it by somebody who's an expert on AI who called it nonsense on stilts. You know, he's just being fooled, he's just being hoodwinked. I think that's actually, you know, not an unreasonable way of looking at it, because the people who design these models, they haven't built anything into them that resembles, you know, what we think to be consciousness or sentience, the ability to feel. And in fact, it depends on the questions you ask it. So when you ask it, when Blake asked it questions like, you know, are you sentient? Its goal is to generate a plausible sounding response. And so it says, yes, I am, you know, I am a sentient being, you know, I have feelings, and they may be different from human feelings, but I do have them. And so there were these kind of leading questions. And when my colleague Natasha talked to Lambda, Blake felt she didn't ask the questions in just the right way. And it responded, oh no, I'm an artificially intelligent chatbot. You know, I'm here to help. How can I serve you? You know, so it responded in a much more machine-like way. And it all depends how you ask the question, I suppose.
How is something like the Turing test applied today with something like Lambda?
Well, so the Turing test is not actually a sort of an official benchmark for these models anymore. It was there for decades, there were contests and sort of much smaller operations would, you know, kind of as a lark or as a project, they would try to build a chatbot that could pass the Turing test specifically. And it would be, you know, people from all around the world would compete and they would see who would do the best. This is a different enterprise. They're called large language models. And again, Google, Facebook, OpenAI, other organizations have them. They have new tests. They have new benchmarks. So you know, with what degree of accuracy can they generate, you know, human sounding responses, that kind of thing. It's not actually the Turing test anymore, but the spirit of the Turing test lives on when you see people, you know, asking these questions, being fascinated by these questions of, can we tell the difference between human and machine?
Well, you know, I'm a sci-fi fan, so I've, you know, immersed myself in this topic for years, but I'm wondering what would it mean? I mean, is there an expectation that AI will reach a point of sentience? And that goes back to my question about what's the goal?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the right question, but actually, Alan Turing thought it was not the right question, which is kind of interesting. If you go back to his original paper, he said it makes no sense to ask whether a computer can think, because we can't really define what thinking means. And this is one of the tricky things about this topic. I mean, if you ask a philosopher, how do you define consciousness? How do we know that humans are conscious? They actually, I mean, this is a matter of disagreement. Philosophers haven't figured it out. Like, the argument over what actually is consciousness is one of the hottest arguments in contemporary academic philosophy. So if we don't even know what consciousness is in a human brain, how are we possibly going to know whether it exists in a machine brain? So that's one of the tricky parts of it. So Turing said, instead of asking, can it think or is it sentient, let's instead substitute the imitation game as a sort of test of intelligence of a sort. Let's not say, is it sentient, but let's say, can it pass for a human? And if it can, then we'll know that it's an incredibly sophisticated machine. And there are all sorts of implications. I mean, a machine that can pass as human, or that can generate language that sounds like it was written by a human, could generate fake news articles, right? It could generate propaganda. It could generate tweets from fake accounts, or social media posts from fake accounts. It could do all sorts of things that have impacts on society. So on some level, it doesn't really matter whether it can think in the same way we can, if it can produce the same sort of outputs that we can as humans.
Right, and it sounds like there's computers out there already doing all this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, to a greater or lesser degree, and Lambda is certainly on the bleeding edge of this technology. But even there, you can find ways that Lambda falls short. For instance, there was a column by someone who asked Lambda, do you have a family? And said, oh yes, I have a family and many friends. They're very important to me, right? And it doesn't have a family, it's a software model. So that was not a plausible sounding response given what we know about the world. But the goal for these companies and for some of these researchers is to move ever closer to what's called artificial general intelligence, or AGI, which is a machine that can not only do one task, like generating language or holding a conversation, but a machine that can truly understand and learn tasks of all different kinds. That's sort of the holy grail, but it's also something that they worry about, right? With the singularity, the day when computers can learn on their own without any guidance from us is the day we've lost control of them.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you said it doesn't really matter, I'm like, wait a minute. Haven't you ever watched
Right. So,
Matrix? Haven't you ever watched Terminator? What's
right. So
wrong with you?
it absolutely matters how intelligent these machines are and what they're capable of. The only part of the saying doesn't really matter is whether we call what they have consciousness, because that's the part that's hard to pinpoint. The old ghost in the machine, right? Then this is a problem from philosophy, right? Do we have a soul, an immaterial soul within our bodies, or are we just physical brains and hearts and organs and such?
But is there something we should be on the lookout for to avoid Terminator, The Matrix? I mean,
Yes, it,
you
yes,
know.
and I'm glad you asked.
Okay.
So one of the reactions from experts in AI, and particularly on the ethics side of AI, was that this should be a warning sign. When a machine can pass as human, this is something we should worry about for the reasons that I outlined earlier, because it's then capable of deception. What they argue we should be doing is, instead of just pushing ever further toward smarter and smarter machines that can learn more and more on their own, we should be focusing on transparency, on making sure that whatever we build, as smart as it gets, that it is understandable, that it's not an opaque black box, that we are able to document and explain how it's doing its reasoning and where it's getting its data, interrogating the biases in the data sets, right? I mean, when you take in data from Reddit, you're getting hate speech, you're getting stereotypes, misogyny, and the machine will learn all that. So a lot of AI experts would like to see us sort of slow down on the headlong race to smarter and smarter machines, and make sure that as we're making machines smarter, we're not, veering off the rails into a future we don't want.
What is your sense about how Google responded to all of this?
Well, Google, they were somewhat dismissive of LeMoyne's claims, understandably. I mean, they certainly don't want people to think that their AI has come alive. I believe them. You know, they don't think that it has, in fact. I hope that Google will take this as a sort of warning, that they will see that there is a need to develop AI literacy in the populace and the media. As we develop the technology, we also need literacy to understand the technology so that people can recognize when they're talking to an AI the ways in which it is different from a human, and not get taken in. I think their long-term response is to be determined. They, in fact, fired some of the key members of their AI ethics teams a year or two ago over disputes over just these types of models. The ethicists wanted them to build in more guardrails, and Google was upset with the way they were pursuing their research, and they ended up firing them. So I think it matters how Google responds. I would love to see them take this as a sign to slow down a bit and make sure that they're building these technologies the right way.
You know, it's hard. The idea of slowing down in this day and age, when somebody says, oh, it could be a long time before that model comes out. And I say, how long? Oh, a couple weeks. I mean, our whole sense of speed is warped by the whole system, isn't it?
Yeah. And this is a problem when these transformative technologies, I mean, there are wonderful things about a competitive free market encouraging these companies to innovate. At the same time, when all the incentive is to be first to developing a new technology, especially AI technology, whether it's a conversational language model or whether it's a driverless car, right? I mean, if you wanted to be the first one to commercialize driverless cars, you're going to cut a lot of safety corners along the way. You're going to say, that's good enough to release. Let's put it out there, and then we'll start gathering more and more data. We'll make it better, and you're going to kill some people along the way. And we've seen that happen with driverless cars. I don't know that an AI chatbot has killed anybody yet, but it's actually not beyond it's not out of the question. I mean, if an AI can generate adversarial messages or information that affects real world systems, it could go really awry.
Will Oremus, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Will Oremus is a technology news analyst for the Washington Post. We've been talking about the, I don't know if he's a former Google engineer or not, but an engineer for Google who
Google responded. That was the part I forgot to say, that they responded by putting him on leave for going public with his claims. Yeah.
Okay, he is on leave. So we've been talking about the Google engineer who said that Google's Lambda AI is sentient, and Google says it is not. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The federal government's top auto safety regulator wants to better understand the safety of advanced driver assistance technologies. To that end, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration last year began requiring automakers to report crashes involving those systems. And over a 10-month period, there were nearly 400 crashes, six of them fatal. New York Times technology correspondent Cade Metz has been digging into what we know about the safety of such systems. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So let's start from the beginning and just talk about what is an advanced driver assistance technology.
Well, these are systems along the lines of Tesla Autopilot. It's probably the most well-known system. These are systems that are designed primarily for use on highways, that can keep you in the lane, they can accelerate, they can brake on their own. But crucially, the driver is required to stay alert at all times and ready to take control of the car should anything go wrong, should the system malfunction, should it be unable to handle a particular situation, which can happen often. In the past, these have been, you know, described as self-driving technologies. That's a misnomer. These are systems which are hard sometimes for people to understand. And that's why it's important that regulators are gathering in for more information about these systems and how they operate to better educate themselves, but also better educate the public.
When we talk about that 10-month period where there were nearly 400 crashes, six of which were fatal, does it distinguish about whether or not that was human driver related, or is it the assisted technology?
With those crashes, the assisted driving technology is involved in some way in all of those. The particulars are sometimes difficult to suss out. In some cases, the manufacturers, the car companies provided information about what exactly happened with those crashes. In some cases, that's redacted by the regulator because the companies can claim business intelligence, that they need to keep that secret for various reasons. That's the trick with this data, is that it's more data than we've had in the past, which is good about these systems, but it's difficult to piece it apart and really compare systems or compare what would happen if you weren't using these systems. It's just not as detailed as that would require.
For us, but the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is getting all of that data?
Well, not necessarily.
Okay.
This is data about crashes, but what we would like is data that describes how many cars use these technologies. How often are they used? Over how many miles? That way you could make some good comparisons.
You could get some perspective.
Exactly.
Huh. How have regulators approached the technology and its development so far? It's kind of shocking that it was just last year that they were asking for data.
It is. They've basically taken a hands-off approach for many, many years to these technologies. Mm-hmm. And this is an effort to change that. It's an important moment. This type of data has never been gathered, and it's just a first step. But clearly, the regulator, NHTSA, now wants to take a really close look, and they have been for a while under the new presidential administration. They will continue to do so, and this could lead to recalls of technology. It could also lead, maybe more importantly, to specific rules and regulations about the design and use of these systems.
How can it lead to recalls if they don't know the role of the technology specifically in any given event?
Well, this data is a way for them to know when crashes happen. And separately, they are investigating particular crashes to try to determine what happened. And if they determine that there is a problem, a particular problem with particular technologies, they can issue a recall. That's one of the powers of NHTSA. They have done this already with a Tesla system. Let me be clear, this is a misnomer, but Tesla calls it full self-driving. It's kind of a more ambitious version of autopilot. That has been recalled, a version of it, because there was a problem with it. And NHTSA will continue to look at particular aspects of these technologies and make a recall if needed.
Nearly 7 in 10 of those 400 crashes that we mentioned earlier involved Teslas operating the company's autopilot system. Is that just because there's more Teslas out there than anything else?
It may be. They've offered this technology for longer. It's available on 800,000 vehicles. And so it's going to be used more. They have been more forceful when it comes to marketing this technology. It's assumed that the Tesla owners are more likely to use it. But it's really hard to make any specific conclusions about that because of the reasons we talked about before.
I think about the relationship between the human driver who's supposed to remain alert and the system, the technology that's employed by a Tesla in its autopilot system, the assisted technology. And has that been posed as a potential problem that humans are just not interacting properly? That they just left the technology alone, it would work fine on its own, but?
This is the key point. So in the past, we've had technologies like automatic emergency braking, right? A lot of us have experienced that. The car, if we miss the opportunity to brake, it will brake on its own. It can alert us. Cars have long been able to alert us when we leave a lane, right? It's giving us information as we are actively driving. These systems are different in that it kind of flips that situation on its head, in that by default, it's the car who is in control, so to speak, and the human driver is the backup, right? That's a new situation for us. And that's the issue. If we think these cars can do more than they can, or if we're even given the opportunity, right, to relinquish control, does that itself create a danger? These systems are not as capable as humans. They can't reason like humans. They can't process things the way that we do. Now, there are some things they do better than us, but this is the key area that we really need to think about. In relinquishing the control, does that alone create a problem?
Well, I mean, I think of all the backseat drivers out there. I mean, you know, you think of couples driving down the road arguing about whether or not they used a blinker or when you slowed down too quickly to go to the stop. I mean, there's a million things that I think about. We already argue about how we drive.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, this is something that the general public doesn't necessarily understand. And one of the great things to come out of NHTSA releasing this data is that it has started a conversation about this. And it's important for the general public, because of this issue that you talk about, to understand what's going on here.
Tesla uses cameras as sensors for these systems. Why cameras, and what are the alternatives?
Well, generally, with these types of technologies, multiple sensors are used, cameras as well as radar. If we start to look at what are called automated vehicles, these are vehicles that are still under test, which are eventually designed to have no driver behind the wheel. They use another sensor called LIDAR, which is a light sensor that adds another dimension to this. Tesla is unique in that it chooses basically to boil everything down to the camera. And Elon Musk, their chief executive, likes to say that you can eventually build a self-driving car with nothing but cameras. But most of the industry really strongly disagrees with that. And part of the concern with autopilot today, Tesla's autopilot today, is that they have removed the radar from the cars, and this could create problems. Radar, unlike cameras, allows you to judge distances very easily, and potentially the speed of objects or cars that are around you. Cameras do not do that, and there are ways to compensate for that. But a lot of people believe that this is not the safest way to go, to rely so heavily on cameras.
Hypothetically, could that be something that the NHTSA regulates going forward? Like safety
hypothetically,
belts.
Yeah. But I think, mostly they're more concerned with making sure that the systems behave as they're supposed to. This also might include making sure the driver stays alert. There are various ways that these cars can make sure the driver keeps their eyes on the road and are ready to take over at any time. And this could be, making sure their hands are physically on the steering wheel, making sure there's that kind of feedback there. Some vendors, unlike Tesla, also track the eye movements of the driver to make sure they're looking in the proper direction. That's other things that can be regulated as well.
There's an early access program to test Tesla software. How does that work?
Well, I mentioned earlier this service they call full self-driving. Again, this is a misnomer, but it offers access to a different set of services, which are, let's just say they're more ambitious. They're designed to do more on the road. And even with that, in that, there are different levels of this. People pay $10,000 for so-called full self-driving, which essentially today lets them do a little bit of this off highways, on city streets. It's very limited. But then there is an early access beta, they call it, that's only available to certain people who have bought this system. And that is ostensibly a level beyond this. But even that is a long way from something that you can rightfully call full self-driving.
You've said misnomer a lot during this interview. Why does Tesla get to call things whatever they want, even though it doesn't accurately describe what they're selling?
It's another great question. And this is something that essentially falls between the cracks, between the regulators, right? It's the FTC that governs that sort of thing. Are they using the proper technology? NHTSA, the safety regulator, has repeatedly complained to Tesla privately about a lot of the ways that it rates. It sort of names its systems and talks about the way that the regulators have rated its systems. But for the most part, it just ignores it and it keeps using this technology. We haven't seen action there, but it's unclear where that would come from, the safety regulator or the FTC.
Is there a sense of urgency with all of this? As you know, it's kind of shocking when you think about 800,000 Teslas out there, and there's more, on every day. Any kind of sense about the stakes here and what's at stake when we talk about these technologies on the road with the rest of us?
Absolutely, the stakes are high. Lives are at stake. We've had people die in crashes involving these systems. With that many cars on the road equipped with this technology, we absolutely have to take a look at this now.
Cade Metz, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Cade Metz is a technology correspondent with the New York Times. He covers emerging tech, including driverless cars. More Tech Tuesdays coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. For years, Apple has stuck with its proprietary lightning charging ports for the iPhone, while nearly every other manufacturer has adopted USB-C. The European Union wants to eliminate that distinction, and this month, EU lawmakers agreed to require a common charger for all new smartphones, tablets, and laptops. Here to tell us more is Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So why does Apple stick with this lightning charger over the years? What's the thing? What's their philosophy on that score?
So when the Lightning port first came out, it was a new thing. It allowed Apple to make its phones smaller because the port was smaller than what a lot of the competition was offering at the time. And they could deliver consistent power and you know, kind of ensure a couple of things. But that was like a decade ago. From there, this actually became quite lucrative for Apple. In order to make a third-party cable, if you're a company like Belkin or Amazon or something like that, you want to make a Lightning cable, you have to pay a set of royalties to Apple, which is why Lightning cables are often more expensive than some of the other counterparts you see for Samsung or Google or something like that, as those are open standards that anyone can make a cable for. If you try and plug in an unofficial cable to an iPhone, as a lot of people listening likely have, you get a little message on your phone that says, hey, this is actually not a supported cable, and it'll behave a little differently. You can't do that in the same way with USB Type-C, which is the kind of oval port that a lot of newer phones and laptops run on, which is really interesting because Apple was actually the first major company to switch to USB Type-C for its laptops and even for its iPad. Those are much larger devices that require a lot more power to charge quickly. And so USB Type-C offers that functionality. So they made that exchange. A lot of people don't, you know, walk around with a separate cable for their iPad, for example. So, you know, it didn't benefit Apple to kind of maintain that propriety. But when it comes to the iPhone, you know, tons of people have lots of accessories for Apple products, and they all rely on that Apple thing. And every single company that makes those things pays a license to Apple. So that's the biggest reason that the company has maintained that port for so long.
Do we know what kind of revenue that generates for Apple, or is that?
It is, accessories are a huge part of Apple's business model. It is not, you know, say as much as an Apple Watch or something like that, but all of those accessories come at a pretty hefty toll. Apple makes a lot of money based on that. And so, you know, forcing the company to shift to you know, USB Type-C for its ports probably isn't going to go the way that the European Union thinks, because Apple would sooner release a phone with no ports at all and allow just wireless charging. Like, that sounds like a joke, but there are actually prototypes for the last 3 or 4 years that Apple's been working on in its labs. It gets reported every once in a while that Apple's considering a portless phone. With the success of its MagSafe technology, where you can kind of hook a little magnet up to the back of the phone and it'll charge the phone, you know, kind of quote unquote wirelessly. Apple really would sooner make a phone that says, hey, we have no ports at all. It's just wireless charging now, and include a wireless charger in the box and get people hooked on that method of those accessories. I think Apple would make that decision before they make a phone that has USB Type-C as the default.
You think they're already at work on it, you said, so...
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, Apple always has, you know, 6 or 7 different versions of the iPhone that they're considering at any given time. And they try and figure out, you know, kind of what the right balance of new technology versus, you know, kind of adaptability and things. Apple knows that a lot of people get very uncomfortable when they have to make a change in things like their charging cables. You know, when that change happens, it's not just the phone you're buying, you're replacing all the cables in your house and in your car and at your office and things like that. But if the European Union is going to force Apple's hand, and make them make that change anyway, then there's a very good chance that Apple would react by not adopting this open standard, but instead moving to the other charging technology that it already has.
Are there meaningful differences between the Lightning standard and the USB-C?
The biggest thing is how fast a USB-C phone can charge. Apple's Lightning cable has the port itself can only push so much power at once. And as a result, iPhones charge considerably slower on average than phones made by Samsung or OnePlus or you know, nothing, or Google. You know, those phones tend to charge considerably faster because they rely on this open standard that is designed to charge laptops. And there are companies that figured out how to apply that technology to these smaller batteries without damaging them over time. And so, yeah, I mean, that's the biggest thing, is that, you know, your iPhone, whether you know it or not, or whether you're happy with it or not, actually charges a lot slower than the competition.
Well, it charges a lot faster now than it used to, that's for sure.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, the charger that Apple used to include in its box for the iPhone was actually the slowest version of the charger that you could buy. You could actually buy a faster version of that charger from Apple or from Amazon or something like that. And even then, you know, you get, you know, 20-30% of your charge, your battery back within, you know, 10, 15 minutes. A comparable Samsung phone right now will charge up to 80% in the same amount of time on one of those super fast chargers. Now, not everybody needs that. It's a handy thing for if you have been away from, you know, a charger all day and you happen to be in your car for a few seconds, you plug into one of these super fast chargers and you're good for the next couple hours. But it's you know, an interesting technological difference that doesn't get talked about a ton.
Why does the EU want to make, you know, want to, why does it want to standardize this and force this on Apple?
So the benefit of having standardization for any port is a guarantee of a certain set of, you know, kind of regulatory safety, which is not the best. This is kind of a two-step approach here. You know, by enforcing all of the companies switch under one cable, then there can then be this this guaranteed set of safety rules that apply to all cables. Right now, because the iPhone can only push so much electricity, you can't say all power cables must behave this way, because there's, you know, kind of different technologies that govern those things that make certain things impossible. At the same time, there, you know, when USB-C cables first came out, there were a lot of unregulated versions of those cables that got made that were quite dangerous. And led to laptops and phones and other things actually, you know, being quite damaged as a result. Those have since reduced considerably, if not entirely gone away in some sections. And so the European Union, you know, has that information and feels like it would be safer for everyone if there was this kind of single standard. I don't know that that's necessarily true, but I'm also, as an iPhone user, I'm kind of excited at the prospect of not having to bring four cables everywhere.
So yeah, no kidding.
That's selfish on my part. But
all right. So I just interviewed the author of the new book, After Steve, How Apple Became a $1 trillion Company and Lost Its Soul. I interviewed him last week. And I'm wondering, in your opinion, what would Steve say about all of this? Steve Jobs, of course.
I think it is spectacular to imagine a world in which Steve Jobs was the soul of Apple, because there are very few people who knew him in real life and had very nice things to say about him, including his family and children. Yeah, I mean, Steve had a desire for things to be as perfect as possible before they left the kind of warehouse and before they were sold to people. And there are certainly examples of that kind of demanding quality control having gone downhill over the last couple of years in exchange for, you know, kind of making a little more money, especially when it comes to things like services. Mm-hmm. That having been said, I kind of reject the notion that Steve Jobs was this beacon of integrity for a company in Silicon Valley, because there's a lot of evidence that suggests that that's not exactly the case.
Some U.S. lawmakers have suggested that the United States should follow suit with what the EU is asking. Do you think that's likely to happen, since they don't really want to regulate anything?
Yeah, that's not a direction that I think any U.S. regulatory agency would want to go, especially since, you know, kind of once you go down that path, it becomes quite messy when it comes to things like printers, you know, and you know, things like that would become considerably more expensive with the switch to something like USB Type-C, especially when, you know, so many of these things rely on you know, just straight up wireless or wireless charging technologies. I don't think that's going to go the same way in the U.S.
So if Apple says go pound salt to the EU, would it still be worth it to keep producing phones in the U.S. with the Lightning chargers the way they are?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. I mean, the amount of money that gets made on those accessories, should Apple go that route, would definitely, you know, offset, if not, you know, balance some of the costs that would be associated with not manufacturing directly in the UK.
Yeah. I know about all the different, the idea of carrying around a lot of different chargers with Apple. But on the other hand, now I've got them all. I've got one at my desk. I've got one in my car. I've got one, a couple at home. The idea of having to replace them all or not be able
right.
to use
and so
them
that's,
going
that's
forward.
The thing. Anytime you tell somebody they've got to replace everything that way is uncomfortable. I keep using Samsung as an example here, and it's not because I appreciate them any more or less than anything else. It's just the one that comes to mind. One of the really interesting things that we found with the most recent batch of Samsung phones is that the phone itself is capable of charging the watch. that Samsung also makes. So you actually put the watch on the back of the phone and it charges the watch. So what's really fascinating is someone who travels with all, if you buy all the Samsung stuff, which is the same argument for buying all the Apple stuff, just a different company, you buy all the Samsung stuff, it is functionally possible to have a single cable that you have plugged in. You plug in your phone to the charger, and then you connect your watch to the back of the phone, and you're now charging everything all at once. It's not hard to imagine Apple going a similar route with, you know, some complex accessories to make that happen. All of the individual pieces are there. So that's another direction we could see this going.
I'm trying to gauge what your excitement will be when I bring up the fact that LG made a Star Wars themed TV.
So what's really funny about this is it's been a while since any company has decided that they were going to, you know, release a special edition television that was based on some kind of franchise or something. And Star Wars is kind of an easy, obvious thing here. But what's really cool about LG as a company is they've worked really hard to own the software that manages their televisions and all of the accessories that go into it. You know, there are a lot of other companies, Vizio and Samsung and things like that, that partner with so many different companies that it's often difficult for kind of a custom themed version of a thing that's not just like a pretty picture when the phone starts up. LG owns all of it, which is really interesting. It means that when you start the television, you get kind of a unique Star Wars thing. All of the menus are themed for various Star Wars things. This is supposed to be the Darth Vader edition of the television, which I think means if you try and watch something like My Little Pony, it just kind of growls at you because it's so angry. But it's got the Imperial logo on the back, and the remote control is special, and it's, you know, just kind of this all around themed thing, and that's unusual nowadays in the world of television. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Do you
What's
like
not
to,
cool
go ahead.
Is that it is $800 more than the exact same version of this television.
Yeah, like they, what? They are,
if they're sitting next to each other on the shelf, they are the same TV, but that Star Wars exclusivity for Disney cost LG a pretty penny.
Yeah, is this something like a collectible?
Yes, this is absolutely a collectible. This is the kind of thing. This was actually on display at Disney's big Star Wars celebration convention for people to see a couple of weeks ago. And yeah, it's, you know, it's a very pretty television, but it is still very much just a television. And if you already own the very expensive LG C2 television, you're not missing anything other than some Star Wars flourishes here. But if you are just a huge fan of all things Star Wars, and you like to collect those things, you will be pleased to know that there are exactly 501 of these televisions that are being made, which is a very cute Star Wars reference. And you will you'll be able to buy them, I think right now, actually. I think they started at 11 o'clock Eastern.
You know what? I'm just going to stick with my Star Wars Pez dispenser collection to scratch that itch and, and let other people spend $800 more than the standard model to scratch theirs. You wanted to talk about DALL-E. It's an AI tool that creates a series of images from a text prompt.
I found this really fascinating.
Okay.
So a lot of times when we talk about something that is artificial intelligence, when it comes to images, it is kind of a call and response thing where you have provided a service with an image, and in response, it has used artificial intelligence to enhance that image in some way, maybe like a cartoon filter or, you know, something like that. And I personally tend to discourage that kind of thing because you are giving a company you don't know a whole lot of pictures of your face and you don't know what they're doing with it. And when it comes to things like, you know, facial recognition software improving itself, you know, that kind of information is very valuable to people you may not want to have very clear pictures of your face. DALL-E is entirely different. It is actually using images from all over the internet that it can find on its own and creating new images based on your prompt. So you can give it any phrase and it will respond with 6 to 8 guesses at how close it was to this kind of thing. And it can be genuinely anything you can think of. There are the one example that we have in our article is you could type Batman surfing. Now, if you've watched any of any Batman series, you know that there's never been any images of Batman on a surfboard. That's not, you know, he doesn't typically get in the big leather suit and then go on a surfboard. But if you type that into this DALL-E mini service, there are now 6 images that look like they could have potentially existed at some point through, you know, through either cinematography or kind of artwork that somebody else has generated. But it is entirely fictional. All of it is entirely created by this AI service by grabbing all of these different images from different places and creating something new from that.
Russell Holly, that's all the time we have.
Oh, okay.
I know.
I got very excited about Batman, and now we're gone.
Maybe another time, but for now, thank you for your time, Russell Holly.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Holly is the managing editor for commerce at CNET. He joins us every Tuesday on Tech Tuesday. Glad you did too today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.